We continue to be so deeply honored to have our most distinguished Dr. Kenneth Cook here with us today, and he's going to talk about gastroparesis and irritable bowel syndrome. Seeing though it's IBS Awareness Month, we continue to be in total awe of you, Dr. Cook, in doing these programs for us every other month. For those who don't know Dr. Cook yet, he is currently a professor of medicine in the section of gastroenterology and hepatology at Wake Forest Baptist Medical Center. He has a very long career interest in understanding pathophysiological mechanisms of nausea and gastroparesis. He is the principal investigator in the NIH-sponsored Gastroparesis Clinical Research Consortium. And he has written over 143 peer-reviewed publications, 43 chapters, and 2 books. For those unfamiliar with our organization, we're the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, or AGMD. We're a nonprofit organization that serves as an educational resource for GI motility disorders. It also functions as an important clearinghouse for members of the medical, scientific, and nutritional communities. And in addition, we provide a forum of support for patients and their families impacted by GI motility disorders. My name is Mary Angela DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient with pseudoobstruction that has progressed to include my entire digestive tract. So I have gastroparesis as well, and I'm also honored to serve as a volunteer for AGMD. The amazing Melissa Adams Van Houten will be co-administrating this program, and she is going to say a few words about herself. Melissa?
Thank you. My name is Melissa Adams Van Houten, and I was diagnosed with gastroparesis a little over 8 years ago in February of 2014. I currently serve as the AGMD's Public Policy and Outreach Director, and I manage several online patient support and advocacy groups.
And all those groups focus on gastroparesis, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Just a few notes. Please be sure you're in a very quiet environment. Otherwise, we can hear everything in the background. In addition to the first part of the program, we will not be doing any questions and answers from the audience. So I have you all on mute because that is reserved specifically for the second part of the program where Melissa will be in charge of the Q&A portion. Dr. Cook, thank you for being with us here today to talk about this important topic. So to start with, can you briefly define IBS and gastroparesis and then take it from there? How's that sound?
Well, that sounds like a plan. So thank you. Thank you very much, Mary Angela and Melissa. And it's good to be here again. I hope everybody can hear me. I usually speak a little loud, and so bear with that. But these are two difficult and important topics, and they frequently go together. So first of all, you know, gastroparesis is defined kind of like in physiological terms. It's delayed gastric emptying in the absence of mechanical obstruction of the stomach. And so the symptoms associated with gastroparesis are particularly after one eats, there can be discomfort, there can be bloating, there can be some pain, there's nausea, there can be vomiting of undigested food. Those are the symptoms that collection of symptoms makes doctors think about the stomach and obstruction or gastroparesis. IBS or irritable bowel syndrome is a more of a colon problem. That is, there's disordered or disordered bowel movements. And so at the time of moving one's bowels, you have everything from diarrhea to constipation. And at this point, I usually like to tell my patients, do they know what the perfect stool is? And of course they go, what? And maybe it's too early to talk about the perfect stool, but you know, I remind them that a colon that is working beautifully from a neuromuscular coordination standpoint, you know, most of humanity has a bulky and soft and easy to pass bowel movement once a day. And they go like, what? You know, I might have had that 5 or 6 years ago, but that's normal. And in the circadian rhythm or in the rhythm of a human body, you know, everything is rhythmic, from your heart rate to your breathing rate to the rhythm of the intestines. Everything has a rhythm. And in the circadian rhythm diagrams, having a bowel movement makes it onto the chart. And it's like, you know, between 8 and 8:30 in the morning, you know, sometime in the early morning there is when most of humanity has a bowel movement. And it should be as close to perfect as possible. And so with IBS, it's hardly, you see, with IBS, you can be quite miserable with abdominal pain, discomfort. And so there's an abdominal pain, discomfort part of it. And then there are these disordered bowel movements. I mean, it's just like the stomach when we eat is supposed to be pleasant, comfortable, satisfying. That's the stomach working normally. And so we've talked about gastroparesis, you know, a number of times before. And like I just said, the symptoms of a dysfunctional neuromuscular stomach, you get all these bad symptoms because it doesn't work. And guess what? In an upper endoscopy and gastroparesis, it's normal. If you have IBS and all that misery of IBS and you get a colonoscopy, it's normal, you see, and everybody gets confused and frustrated. But it's normal because, you know, these symptoms are not coming from the lining of the stomach. They're not coming from the lining of the colon. So they are the stomach and the colon. Afflictions in the neuromuscular disorder sense. We've talked about this. And actually, there's more known about, I would say, the different parts of the stomach, the different cells that aren't quite right, than we know physiologically about IBS. And so, you know, when you go to diagnose IBS, it tends to be a diagnosis based on symptoms. And you can make the diagnosis on symptoms alone if there aren't red flags. And red flags in a doctor's mind are other aspects of what you tell the doctor. For instance, yes, I'm having a hard stool, but I notice blood in it. That's a red flag. And you know, the red flag means you probably do need a colonoscopy. The blood can be wine colored. Maybe that's bleeding a little higher up. Maybe there's some blackness, the black tarry stool, which could be usually higher, small bowel or even stomach. So those are things that would move the doctor to do some diagnostic tests. Certainly fever and chills plus pain is not irritable bowel. And so there may need to be some blood tests, even a CAT scan, colonoscopy, you know, to work up these symptoms when you start getting into these red flags. Weight loss, for instance, would be another one. So bleeding, fevers and chills, weight loss, those are things that should not be happening with irritable bowel. The other one I like to ask about irritable bowel is, you know, if you have the loose stools or the discomfort or pain, do those symptoms wake you up at night? So usually in an irritable bowel patient, once sleep occurs, these GI symptoms do not wake you up.
if those symptoms are waking you up, you're waking up with pain, you're waking up with diarrhea, that usually suggests more than IBS to me. So it's another thing to tell the doc, on visits. So those are the sort of those two symptom areas, I guess. The other thing for IBS is pretty much the symptoms should be present for 3 to 6 months. The symptoms may be subtyped into you've got abdominal pain, discomfort, distension, and you're constipated. Or on the other hand, you have these abdominal pains and discomforts and distension, but you have diarrhea. So it's IBS-C for constipation, IBS-D for diarrhea predominant. And then of course in GI, nothing is carved in granite. I guess if it was carved in granite, our colons would be made of granite or something. Hardly the case. Everything is very mobile, very fluid. It's all nerve and muscle doing its job. And so there's a lot of indeterminates there. Some weeks there's constipation, and then it evolves to diarrhea, and it's all over the place. So back in the old days, it was called spastic colitis even. Irritable bowel is okay. You can certainly think of the nerve and muscle in the colon as irritated, and it's just not functioning. So, they can be differentiated pretty well. And for the gastroparesis, we've talked about it in the past. There's a standard 4-hour egg beater study that tells us if we have gastroparesis or normal emptying or rapid emptying. And I think I've mentioned before that if I saw patients with the nausea and discomfort after eating, perhaps vomiting now and then, these symptoms sound like gastroparesis, but maybe 3 out of 10 people I see, will it be actually a slow stomach defined? 6 or 7 out of those 10 will have normal emptying. And we've talked about sometimes folks get labeled with this bad idea of functional dyspepsia. It's a bad idea because those two words are terrible. Don't know what they mean. And then there's a few people who have rapid emptying, dumping syndrome. So there are diagnostic tests to go through. And our NIH Gastroparesis Consortium has been writing several papers now that begin to elucidate that gastroparesis patients who have the symptoms I mentioned and normal emptying, and delayed emptying, and those who have normal emptying are really kissing cousins. They are closely related in the spectrum of more subtle neuromuscular problems. And what I mean is those two groups have very similar problems with accommodation. That is accommodation into the water load satiety test. They have equal numbers of patients who cannot drink very much water, and they get nauseated and full. And there were equal numbers of gastric dysrhythmias. And so these more subtle but important functions of the stomach are really very similar in gastroparesis and in functional dyspepsia. So I think as we go through the diagnostic tests for the gastroparesis, we're getting a little bit smarter on what should we be attacking in terms of treatment. And for the IBS, we want to make sure we're treating IBS. And if there's red flags or other kinds of symptoms, we may want to look into some other ideas. And you can see I'm flipping back and forth between IBS and gastroparesis, because if somebody has really, I always get like for constipation patients, like a thyroid. It's easy to measure the thyroid stimulating hormone. You don't want to miss hypothyroidism causing a constipation, which doesn't need a laxative. It needs more thyroid hormone. And so again, like I said, depending on age and other issues, there may be a few diagnostic tests to get to the bottom of the what's driving that even those IBS symptoms. And then to bring them together further, that is the gastroparesis, functional dyspepsia, IBS, really in that patient group with the upper symptoms, I'm going to estimate 60% to 70% of my patients with gastroparesis and FD have an IBS component problem. And so very frequently, those two problems are seen together. And you know, for a lot of gastroparesis and people have trouble with, you know, food, and it develops the, even with normal gastric emptying, the patients with functional dyspepsia and accommodation problems or rhythm problems have trouble ingesting much in the way of fibers. They're too much, they're too heavy, they create symptoms. And so patients start cutting back on their vegetables, certain grains, brands, because it makes them more bloated, or they can't tolerate it at the stomach level. And then guess what the colon starts to see? The colon starts to see less and less undigestible fibers. The colon was made to deal with undigestible fibers. That's its livelihood. The bacteria, the microbiome, are there to help break down those fibers, make vitamins, create a bulky, soft, easy to pass stool. Now, because of the upper GI problems, colon's not getting what it needs. And guess what? It starts misbehaving. There's no reason to have a bowel movement if you're not eating much in the way of undigestible fibers. And so before long, you're not going. And then to me, the colon is a muscle that also needs its daily exercise, and it's not happening. And so I think even to some degree, the gastroparesis FD kind of issues can aggravate the colon's issues, or it can lead to more colon problems. And at the same token, let me turn the tables. And that is, if you have a milder gastroparesis or milder upper symptoms, but you have severe irritable bowel. I have patients, you know, who don't have a bowel movement for 5, 6, 7 days. Yet they eat every day, maybe not a perfectly normal diet, maybe a low fiber diet, but they eat. And, you know, if you don't go every day, but you eat every day, there is at least some food that gets into the colon for the microbiome and the colon to begin to work on. But, you know, that undigestible foods then begin to build up. They build up on the left side, then they build up, that would be the descending colon, then they build up across the transverse colon. I mean, the colon can be like they say on the CT scans, the patient has a heavy burden of stool throughout the colon. Wow, they got that right. A heavy burden of stool. Yeah. And so these patients then, when they eat, that food's in the stomach, well, the colon says, you know, I don't think so. We're full down here. I don't think we need that. And so I think it's important for all of you to remember a very important quote. And I think I just made it up, but it's no colon is an island. Mary Angela will have to remind me who actually correctly.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't stop laughing because I think the quote is so good.
Maybe it was, I don't know, maybe it was Nero or somebody, some listener will write in and say, so why do I say no colon is an island? Because because that colon that is now burdened hasn't gone in a few days. You know, it's full of neurons that are talking to the small bowels, talking to the stomach, and the GI tract wants to work in harmony. And, you know, the colon's just not doing its job, and it's sending messages back to the stomach. And it says, you know, no, there's no room here. We're full. You know, in fact, we're a little ticked off that you even tried to eat that bagel. And, you know, why don't you just go get nauseated, and maybe you ought to just throw it up, because we'd be happier down below. So I have some patients, even with gastroparesis, that I say, you know, let's just take some time and work on your colon. Let's get that working. I don't care what it takes, laxatives, twice a day, laxatives, bigger, but we got to get the colon to move. And so this is a big problem as in folks who have considerable gastroparesis and considerable IBS, you know, issues. So if you want to then go one step further in the problem of neuromuscular aspects of the GI tract, we now know that people, and again, it could be as many as 50% of people who have pretty significant, you know, moderate constipation will have small bowel bacterial overgrowth. So what is small bowel bacterial overgrowth? Well, small bowel indicates that there's a problem in the small bowel, and the problem is decreased contractility, decreased motility, and mainly it's in moving small bowel contents down the 20 feet of small bowel downstream into the colon. Because there are some bacteria in the small bowel, and if you don't keep moving materials down to the colon, they begin to build up. You could call it, you know, stagnant pond. You could call it stagnant pond syndrome. Yeah, I like that one. Stagnant pond. What happens in a stagnant pond? You get all kinds of algae and other things build up. Well, in the small bowel, bacteria can build up and you get bacterial overgrowth. And now when you eat and some food, it can trickle out of your small, out of your stomach, it can get out however it gets out. And as soon as those nutrients get into the contact with the bacteria of the small bowel, they begin to ferment those, especially the starches, the sugars, and now you have gas and distension and nausea after you eat. And pretty soon you and your doctor are quite confused. Are these symptoms coming from the stomach dysmotility? Are they coming from the small bowel dysmotility? Are they coming from the colon? And could you also say, my gosh, do I have all three? And you certainly could have all three. And they're not to the degree of severity, which we call pseudo-obstruction, where, you know, the stomach or the small bowel or the colon or all three are really maximally, abnormally dilated. And they're yet another stage. But what I'm talking about is really a pan. Sometimes you hear the word panmotility, just means this problem's a motility problem. A neuromuscular problem is affecting stomach, small bowel, and colon. So as I said, the system is harmoniously linked in health, because I could also add most of my patients have GERD. So, you know, thank goodness we have great drugs for GERD, because you can pretty much treat that. You know, someday we'll have drugs like this for all these areas. And then the unforgotten organ is the gallbladder. And most of my patients have had their gallbladders out. Either it helped something or it didn't help anything, but it's gone. And so I don't have to worry about it. So when I see a patient who has some of these symptoms, I often think to myself, well, wait a minute, the gallbladder can make you feel nauseated and uncomfortable after you eat too. There's usually not the distension part, but so, you know, if your gallbladder hasn't been assessed recently or at all, really shouldn't forget about the gallbladder. So, you know, there's a lot to all of this, and but the good news, bad news is, you know, Mary Angela wanted me to talk a little bit about treatment, but the bad news is there aren't a whole lot of drugs or treatments. The good news is it's not a long talk about treatment. We've talked in some detail about the stomach and gastroparesis and how it starts with diet, really understanding how your stomach is not very strong. It's neuromuscularly has its problems, whether it's accommodation or emptying, and rhythm for subtyping purposes. But diet can help help you stay hydrated and nourished and keep the symptoms under control. To help the stomach empty faster, we have Reglan, which we rarely prescribe for short times. We have drugs like Bethanacol, Mestinon, that we borrow from other specialties. And there's a whole bunch of drugs for nausea that can be tried. Actually, it's interesting. We don't know as much about the colon, but we seem to have more drugs right now. I always start with just, you know, Miralax, even a little old-fashioned little tiny pill, like a Ducalox tablet, to try to get the bowels to move every night, or every morning, I mean. I try to reproduce Mother Nature. Who could be against Mother Nature? And I say, Mother Nature says most humans have a bowel movement in the morning. So I have my patients take their laxative like 8 or 9 p.m., hoping they'll work overnight. And then with the morning coffee or tea, they'll have that, what is a normal gastrocolonic reflex and urge to have a bowel movement. And so they do, hopefully. And but you can escalate up to, you know, escalate up to drugs like Linzess, linaclotide. You get more secretions from the small bowel. Those secretions help move the colon. Then we have new drugs like Motegrity or Prucalopride that are for IBS-C. So there are some drugs out there for constipation that are available, and they, you know, some of these molecules may be just what you need, and to get those bowels to move at least every other day. Sometimes I think a goal at least is every other day. That's still pretty normal. It actually is normal every other day. You don't have to go every day, even by the you know, healthy population studies, every other day is still considered normal. So, and then, you know, in some of my patients then with gastroparesis, of course, we don't like a high fiber diet. You can't go with a lot of Metamucil or Citrusil are my soluble fibers that I like to use. And I'll just briefly make a comment about fiber. So people think fiber means I should be eating salads, celery, carrots. But I really write on my patients' cards here, you know, you need soluble fiber. And so I say, you eat your diet, you know, your gastroparesis, you're handling your diet, or you're diabetic, and well, diabetic's a different story, because if they have gastroparesis, they really do need to cut down on regular fiber. But soluble fiber, hardly anybody knows what soluble fiber is. So, Mary Angela, should I take a moment to talk about soluble fiber?
Yes, because I know some people want to know what they can eat. And if you have gastroparesis and irritable bowel, now that changes things.
Yeah, that's really hard to get in fiber. But soluble fiber is fiber that will soak up water. It works like a sponge, actually. So if you got a tablespoon of, let's say, Citracil or Miralax, and you put a tablespoon and 8 ounces of water and stirred, and then back away for 5 minutes, come back in 5 minutes and look at the water. It is now like jello. The soluble fiber soaks up the water like little sponges. And so as you drink that day after day, week after week, and as it gets into your colon, it provides the bulk of the normal, bulky, soft, easy to pass stool, provided the colon has the strength to push it out. And that's what that's where you have to find the right patient and the right colon. But now imagine cutting up into tiny little bits a carrot, and take that tablespoon of cut up carrot fragments and stir it in 8 ounces of water. What do you think it's going to look like in 5 minutes? It's going to look like carrots in water. That's insoluble fiber. So that's why we like these soluble fibers that we add in small amounts, but increase over time to give that colon bulk. And there is a product called Benefiber, which is really dissolves without grittiness, can dissolve in coffee or tea. And I can sometimes get patients to sneak in a little bit of soluble fiber who have gastroparesis using that kind of sneak approach to getting some fiber in, at least if they can tolerate it. So I think maybe Angela, I'll stop here to say, you know, wow, gastroparesis on one side and irritable bowel, constipation, or diarrhea, both on the other side, bad combo. A lot of work to do to keep those two organs working. We talked about how the small bowel can get involved. But, you know, when you know what the problem is, that's what you call divide and conquer. There's a breath test for small bowel bacteria overgrowth. It is diagnosable, at least with a simple breath test. At least it can lead you in that direction. A treatment there is antibiotics. You can at least get that component beat down while you work on the others. So anyway, I will stop there and take questions. All right, Angela?
Yes. Before I give the program over to Melissa, do you find that the combination of gastroparesis as well as IBS is more prevalent in one particular sex versus the other?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Certainly the gastroparesis FD is, you know, 70-80% women. IBS is a little more balanced between men and women, but still I'd say 60-40 women. So I still, in my referral clinic, it's and in the NIH, it's with all those other attributes I mentioned that we see people with gastroparesis FD, and then they have IBS and they have GERD, it is still predominantly a women's disease, even the combination.
Interesting. Yeah. And you had touched upon microbiome, and I know you could probably do a whole program and then some on it, but some people may not know what it is. Can you just briefly describe it, and then I'll hand it over to Melissa?
Yeah. The microbiome is kind of like the new word over the last 10-12 years for the collection of bacteria that is housed in our colons. And every individual seems to have, and families have the same collection of literally billions of bacteria in the colon that today people think the health of that community of bacteria is really important to the health, everything from mental health to cardiac health to GI health. It's quite amazing the studies that are going on with the microbiome, but it's really those billions of bacteria, all different kinds of species living together in our colons and actually helping metabolize those fibers that we cannot absorb. So it's a huge area right now of research interest.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Thank you for that. Melissa, I'm going to put the program in your hands and you can do the Q&A. How's that?
Okay, thank you very much. Before I just open it up to questions, I was reading through some of the common themes in the questions that had been submitted. Can you talk a little bit about what a doctor means when he says it's a functional disorder, and are IBS and gastroparesis considered functional?
Yeah, it's a great question. Why? Because I have banned the word functional. That word is banned. It's banned in Boston, I'm pretty sure, but it's banned at Wake Forest. When I talk to our fellows and anybody who wants to talk about it, because I think the word doesn't mean anything physiological, and it has the connotation that it's in your head. And, you know, I think a better way to put it is that there are neuromuscular disorders. These are neuromuscular disorders of the stomach, the small bowel, the colon, and they create dysfunction. They definitely create dysfunction. But the dysfunction, whether it's diarrhea or the constipation or the nausea, the dysfunction comes from, you know, subtle problems of nerve, muscle, and pacemaker cells of the GI tract. And this is like neurogastroenterology. And so this is an area, you know, that's evolving in its diagnostic and therapeutic sophistication. So hopefully as years go on, no, it's not. You know, what you have is a gastric dysrhythmia and accommodation problem. You have a pelvic floor problem and a anal sphincter problem. And this is where your constipation is coming from. We won't have to say IBS-C in the future. I don't like the word. Don't use it. Ask your doctor, can you use another word? Dr. Cook doesn't like that word.
I'll be telling everybody that from now on, yeah. Do you think that there's still a sense out there, maybe among physicians, but certainly in the public, that IBS and maybe even gastroparesis aren't real or they aren't serious disorders? And do you think that emphasis on functional can somehow contribute to that view?
Absolutely. In fact, there are parts, and this is kind of, philosophies on a large level. There's certain groups in GI that want to call these, you know, brain gut problems. And to the extent that, let's emphasize the brain and stress. And so my take has been more physiology of the end organ. So the end organs are like, let's talk about the stomach. That's an organ in the periphery. And that organ reports to the brain. And the brain can do some things to the stomach as well. So when somebody's nauseated and they're they're pushing or they're pointing to their, you know, upper abdomen, you know, that's where I'm oriented, and more, you know, end organ physiology type doctors might be oriented towards there and figure out what's wrong with the stomach. But if something's wrong with the stomach, you know, the brain needs to know, you know, and when there's something wrong in the stomach and the brain says that there's nausea down there or there's pain, and I'm going to report it to my spouse or my doctor, we call it a symptom. We don't call it a brain problem, we call it a symptom. And it's a bit aggravating because if I'm having chest pain and I go to the cardiologist, the cardiologist doesn't start out by asking me, you know, am I, you know, am I stressed out about this? Am I having some sort of a depression thing, anxiety problem? No, they say, well, let's go check out your heart. So every organ has a, you know, organ brain connection. And I think that connection really should be considered like reporting. I think the brain reports symptoms of a problem in the periphery. And in the GI tract, of course, that's from esophagus to the anus. We have a problem here. And that's a symptom. So yeah, I think the word function is not helpful in any of these areas. It's been there for 50 years. And it usually, it reflects ignorance on the part of doctors and researchers who haven't been able to, you know, understand the symptom better. Like I said, it's what we're talking about today is way beyond endoscopy. Endoscopy looks, I love to do endoscopy, but the limitation is that it looks at the lining, and that's about it. And so you find out you don't have an ulcer, you don't have cancer, that's good, but what do you have? Well, what do you have? You need to move on to the neuromuscular test that we have of the GI tract. Anyway, how do you like that?
I like that. That's a very good explanation. Thank you. Miss Erin had a question. E-R-I-N, Erin, are you on the call today, Miss Erin? Okay, I will read her question. Why does it seem that often a provider just says it's IBS and gives up on testing or searching for a more accurate diagnosis? It seems like some who are labeled as having IBS end up having a mast cell disorder, gastroparesis, or some other motility disorder. Why is this? And I think, you know, what she's asking is this sort of a fallback diagnosis when GIs don't know what's going on? Do they just say, oh, it's IBS and dismiss you? Or are there actual reasons that they classify it as that and don't do any further testing?
Yeah, another good question. Because, you know, the motility societies and so on have generally said you can make the diagnosis without doing a lot of expensive tests. But, you know, it depends on, you know, if it's a 18-year-old or, you know, a 22-year-old, maybe you can start with, you know, some increase in soluble fiber and some antispasmodic drugs like dicyclamine, which is Bentyl or Levsin. And, you know, you get it started, and if in 6 or 8 weeks they come back and they're all better, I mean, literally 100% better, then that's probably good enough. But if it's a 40-year-old or, you know, 50-year-old and they're just developing these symptoms, that should be a bit more worrisome. You may still start out with, you know, relatively simple things depending on where the person is at their PCP, primary care. Have they gone up to a gastro? I like to check a vitamin D and a thyroid. And, you know, I don't do a big evaluation maybe initially, but at a certain age, yeah, you're going to want to look in there and perhaps do that colonoscopy. And then to back up from even from that, you know, by the time I describe what happens after you eat with gastroparesis and the small bowel and the gallbladder, you got to be careful to blame everything on the colon and possible IBS. And so, you know, patients know this, doctors are busy, but, you know, you got to either keep coming back, call them back and say, well, it's still not right. And so, you know, good medicine is actually follow-up. You know, you got to get followed up to see if what was tried worked. You know, it's like doing an experiment and walking away. Oh, I don't really care what happened 8 hours after I mixed these two chemicals. No, it's hard. The doctor's busy, but still follow-up is where you figure out, did what I try work? Am I done? Or it didn't work at all, or it partially worked. It's an ongoing thing, especially in these motility disorders, where the standard tests may come back. You know, yeah, you're talking about doing no tests, but you know, even this, and then when the standard tests come back normal, it's good news, bad news. It's okay, it's not my gallbladder. I don't have an ulcer. I don't have colitis. So what do I have? And then you get perhaps thrown into these IBS FD categories. But like I say, there are tests to do with the stomach and the small bowel. The colon doesn't, there's a few motility tests. There's a smart pill capsule. There's anal rectal manometry. There's defecography. So, you know, there are tests to push on and study the nerve and muscle function of all these areas now.
Miss Janine has a question. Are you on the line, Miss Janine? I will read her question then. Ms. Janine asks, if you have both gastroparesis and IBS, what is the best way of controlling them? And how do you tell the difference between a gastroparesis attack and an IBS attack so that, you know, if there are different ways of treating them, how do you know which one it is that you should be treating?
Yeah, those are tough ones. I think for IBS, if it's IBS-C, you know, you're trying very hard every day with your laxatives to have a bowel movement every morning or every other morning. And if you're going, you know, 4 and 5 days, I would start blaming my colon on some of my misery. Mary Angela, are you ready? Because I'm about to say, don't forget that no colon is an island. And your colon that hasn't worked for 4 days is probably talking back to your small bowel and stomach and saying, come on, I'm holding things up here to some degree. And so, you know, I might work on the laxative part a bit harder. When the stomach's not working right, you know, boy, the food's there. People tell me, you know, it sits like a brick. I can feel it. I just can't stand it anymore. And up comes chewed food. I mean, that's a gastroparesis attack. And for some reason, it was the food chosen. It was something else. Who knows, you know, what triggers those attacks. Usually the patient knows. What happened. And often it's, you know, okay, I'm tired of my gastroparesis diet. You know, I'm going to eat this. I just want to. So really hard to tell which might be the offending one at any one time. But there's a couple ideas for you. But otherwise, yeah, I think I do want my patients with gastroparesis. If it's just laxative, fine. They can't take fiber. I get it. And you just work with your laxatives there. Gastroparesis, wow, we've spent entire hours talking about treatment for gastroparesis, and starts with diet, you know. And as I mentioned about the last 6 months, we are working on a book. the book, I hope, on how to eat when you're nauseated. Hopefully it goes to the publisher in a week or two. But that book is builds on what I've coached people for many, many, many years on how to eat when they have mild nausea, moderate nausea, severe nausea, to avoid dehydration, stay nourished. And that's what you do, you know, and if you're lucky, you have a drug that works, like Zofran knocks the nausea down. Maybe you've got a touch of Reglan to help the stomach empty a little bit. But these are tough areas when the problem is if you're in a exacerbation. Yeah. Anyway, those are some ideas.
Okay. Miss Susan K, are you on the program today? They're either here and very quiet, or they couldn't make it.
Well, it's nice that they sent in their questions, because you know, they may have been reading my mind. Maybe they actually knew what I was going to talk about before I talked about it. So, but we do like to hear people's live voices too. But Susan's question, please. What is Susan's question?
And I would remind people too that sometimes when they submit questions, they are unable to attend, but they listen to the recording. The shows are recorded, so those will be up on the website at some point. And I know a lot of them do go back and review the answers, so that's pretty helpful. Miss Susan asks, are there complementary therapies that might help both gastroparesis and IBS?
Yeah. There are, and it's probably been worked out a little bit more in IBS. And it's done partly because we don't have great drugs, and it's partly because these are very irritating, anxiety-provoking, depressing illnesses. And so psychology has gotten quite involved. They call it cognitive behavioral therapies. There are a lot of ways that you can use psychology, including deep breathing, for instance, just to ratchet down some of the, I guess you'd call it, anxieties and other responses to these ongoing symptoms. That's kind of where I would come from this, is that to me, a lot of these responses, you know, are what happens when you have this particular kind of GI symptom, you know, day after day, month after month. You know, it wears one down and you get into all these other problems. I mean, if I have tennis elbow every day, okay, yeah, I can't hit the ball quite as hard. Yeah, it's my elbow. Okay, I get it. But it's not affecting, you know, how I eat, how I interact around the social time at dinner. I'm excusing myself. I got to go vomit. I have to go to bowel movement. You know, nobody, yeah, amongst all the different, holy cow, even if I had chest pain now and then, okay, I take a nitro. I feel better. Let me have dessert now. I think that's what the GI disorders wipe out, a lot of social context for people. And so, yeah, you know, I have patients, they saw a psychologist and they're feeling a bit better about life in general. But Dr. Cook, why am I still nauseated after I eat? Or, it helped, but I still can't have a bowel movement. So these things are complementary. And everything from aromatherapy to massage, a little bit on yoga, all these things are looked at a little bit. I wouldn't say in great detail, but you know, they certainly don't harm anybody, and they might, in fact, you know, help with coping with a lot of the social issues that go along with these disorders, that, you know, that knock you out of family and friend mealtimes.
Yeah, absolutely. One last question I think we have time for was submitted by just the first initial K. When cancer radiation permanently damages the stomach, food and medication sensitivities can result along with gastroparesis. Are these sensitivities considered IBS, and is there any treatment for those aside from steroids?
Yeah, that's another bad one. Bad in that radiation damage, you know, if radiation had to be given, you know, to cure a cancer or to, whether it's the colon, the uterus, stomach, lymphomas, you know, it's a it's a injury to those surrounding tissues, and you know, to me, it's beyond a sensitivity. I mean, it can induce enough damage to cells, especially neurons, pacemaker cells, that yeah, you have a dysrhythmia, you have poor accommodation, you have gastroparesis. In the colon and the rectum, particularly where the organs don't move around much, you can get radiation damage that includes bleeding, things, diarrhea. So these are, to me, beyond, you know, IBS for sure. And if the stomach doesn't empty, or you have dysrhythmia and so on, no, these, then I'd rather call it gastroparesis. I'd rather call it gastroparesis with dysrhythmia, and get that pathophysiologic name on it. To me, it's a little different. These are these symptoms and these problems secondary to X, Y, or Z. It might be radiation. Somebody else, it might be after surgery, they removed half the stomach, and now they have gastroparesis. You see what I mean? I'd like to see, to then here you have, you know what injured the stomach, and the problem goes from there. It shouldn't be referred to as a sensitivity or a functional thing, for instance, in my mind.
Thank you. I will go ahead and, well, thank you for joining the program, and thank all of you who have listened in today for joining us. And I will hand this back over to Mary Angela.
Thank you very much. Questions are still coming in, and I wish we could get to every single one of them, but time is of the essence here. So, Melissa, thank you for the Q&A part of the program. You always do such a fantastic job. And you always represent the voice of the patients in such a good way. We're beyond grateful for your service to AGMD and all the gastroparesis communities. And Dr. Cook, as always, we're deeply grateful for the most gifted way you impart your knowledge. You have such patience, understanding, explanations, and you have you implement the incredible art of listening. And these are the characteristics that has given you the tremendous following that you do have. He's a remarkable physician and humanitarian, Dr. Cook is, and his passion for researching and educating and helping patients is truly so admirable. Dr. Cook, you define what a beacon of hope truly is. And to all of you, as I speak from my heart, know what incredible heroes you are to me. Your eagerness to learn, share your stories, and support each other is humbling. And remember that each and every day you remain in my thoughts, in my heart, and in my fervent prayers. May God bless you all. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.